Do you like movies?
Hola again. It's the weekly episode of Taking It Down. We're the Alabama Takes Pop Culture Podcast. I'm the host of the show and the editor-in-chief of that website. My name's Blaine Duncan. Joining me today will be co-host Adam Morrow and quite frequent co-host Natalie Morrow.
No relation. No. We just happen to be in the same house right now, but opposite ends of the house.
In a bit, we're going to be talking about three things. The documentary Summer of Soul, which is now on Hulu. The Netflix series Somos. And the most recent episode of the Disney Plus show Loki, which had just aired episode 4. So let's get into it. No Donovan this week. I wonder, what's the over-under of percentage of listeners who are happy about that?
I didn't know where you're going to go with that. What's the over-under of how many fingers Donovan survives the 4th of July with? What's the over-under on if he's summering in Cape Cod at this point? He's been in the Northeast long enough.
Oh, he's in Cape Cod.
He has a summer home out there, right? Maybe something on Nantucket.
He's thoroughly a New Englander now. He probably drops words like nor'easter and stuff.
Casually.
And it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have no idea what a nor'easter is.
I saw The Perfect Storm. I get it.
Well, we are going to talk about Summer of Soul. So let's just jump right into it, because I think maybe our segment on Loki at the very end might run a little longer than I actually suspected it will, because it turned out to be a revelatory episode. To start this week, perfect for 4th of July viewing, if you happen to catch it, was the debut of the documentary Summer of Soul. It dropped in theaters and on Hulu simultaneously, which I was happy to find out. I thought it was only going to be theatrical until Adam cued me in. That was pretty thrilling. It's subtitled Or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, and captures the events of the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival. That was a festival in Harlem, if you can believe it. Harlem, hence the title, right? But it was throughout the summer of 1969. Adam, help me out here. Did they also start it in like the summer of 1967 and had a few shows in 67 and 68?
I couldn't. That was something that I was interested in, is the progression of the festival that they didn't really touch on. They kind of hinted that the promoter, who was, I'm going to blank on his name, I'm going to feel really bad because he was a central character in the film, but that he had a lot of pies in the air, a lot of things going, and maybe it had, 1969 was like the peak when everything came together.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it continued on or not.
1969 had multiple shows, weeks of in July and August. Anyway, the documentary is directed by Questlove, Amir Thompson. You know him from The Roots, from The Tonight Show. But this is his debut as a director, and it helps take the sole focus off of Woodstock of 1969 and that bit of rock history, and instead start to include artists like Stevie Wonder, Sly and the Family Stone, Nina Simone, Gladys Knight and the Pips, B.B. King into that conversation of 1969 music that was happening. Okay, well, we're going to get right into it. If you haven't watched it, I mean, it's a documentary. It's very unspoilable, especially with a music documentary. It's a music documentary that's documenting a concert is damn near unspoilable. But if you just want to watch it before you hear us talk about it, then it's on Hulu. Go watch. Directing a documentary is so different than directing a feature film. And Adam, you've actually worked on an award-winning documentary. I can say that, right?
That is technically true.
It's technically true. It is. The thing about you and having you, I'm going to brag on you guys. The thing about having you, Donovan, Natalie, and some of our other friends is that you've had so much experience in different successful things. So I can rely on you on like, I can rely on you and Josh and Hayden for like, okay, this song, what does it sound like in the studio?
Why does this song suck?
Why does this song suck? I mean, that's really, it's true. But I can also rely on you on the documentarian questions and editing questions, because you worked a lot in editing. I can rely on Donovan for like 1940s movies. I mean, you know, just a wealth of knowledge between all these people I know. It's fun. But we got this documentary. What's the biggest or most important part of a documentary, do you think? And did Questlove nail it with this debut of his?
This was not the award-winning documentary, but one that I worked on from start to finish. I think you take in a ton of information and you understand the scope of this big, giant story. and you kind of fall in love with all of the details, and you wonder, how am I going to pare that down from, I'm sure at some point, you know, they're sitting around, they're like, well, how are we going to, specifically, it's easy to explain with music, like, how do we not include this song? How do we not include this performance, this storyline? I mean, there's probably so much that is left out. I'm sure he could do a 10-part, 10-hour podcast about, you know, how did, it was hinted at, like, how did you convince all these people to perform? What was the vibe like backstage that day? So narrowing the focus down to what you want to say and how you want to say it is a real challenge, and I thought that he did an incredible job of it. It was a linear story. Any asides added to the film more than they slowed things down. It felt like it was in perpetual movement. And I think, you know, you said you can't really spoil a concert that happened, which is true, but when I was telling my buddy Jamie about this, I started to tell him some of the performances, and then I stopped because I mean, some of them are so moving, and the combination of people and what they're doing is so profound. I found it to be very profound, that I was like, you should watch it in the order that the film presents it. So I think creating drama like that out of, you know, they show the lineup at the beginning, but still creating drama out of that is a, I mean, organizing the story and creating that drama is just very impressive.
He had 45 hours of footage, I think, to work with.
And the thing, it's kind of like the, you know, we joked about the Beatles doc that Peter Jackson's doing, the shift away from a theatrical release to a 6-part Disney Plus thing, and how for the truly dorky and committed among us, that's a great thing, because, you know, I would watch as much of that show as they wanted to put out. Both the Beatles and what Questlove did. If he was like, here's the vault, that I'd watch them all, basically.
Dorks like us. Yep. All right, let's go around in our circle. What did you take away from this film?
I think the biggest thing for me, and it's been a long time since I've watched any of like the Woodstock documentaries, but it was interesting, one, to see. I told Adam this after we got finished watching it. It's like, I feel like when we watch the Woodstock docs, like when they interview the past musicians or even people that were there, it's like all the people look so old and like one foot in the grave, and they just look terrible. And that was not the case with this one. But also like thinking of like the stories that they're telling, like this doc talked to, I mean, it was a lot of people, like the joy and the people and the families that were there and like celebration of the culture and all of this stuff, instead of it being about free love, the drugs, the whatever, that I feel like is always what. And like I said, it's been a long time since I've seen the Woodstock stuff, so maybe that's not fair to say, but that was kind of my takeaway. Of
the footage was really, really good. It was pristine. And the footage from Woodstock, it just feels like 1969. The footage from this felt more like 79. It still felt dated, but felt stylish. And the beat in the Woodstock footage does not feel stylish. It feels like, geez, that's 1969 for sure. You know, these people were cool looking. That's what I'm trying to say. They just look so hip and vibrant.
I think on that topic, the way, and Natalie kind of already made this point, but the way that it centered it on a community, you know, that it was a place. Woodstock was a destination. It's very,
I like that.
Very almost boomer-ish, maybe a cruel way of saying it, because our generation does the same thing, but that you would, you know, convert this farm into a space for music, which is a great idea. It's a cool idea. Festivals are great. But the idea of something that happened every weekend for a whole summer in a community that was undergoing radical change was really neat to see. I mean, the part where they've landed on the moon and people are reacting to that, and, you know, saying why are people going hungry in Harlem, but also, you know, it doesn't linger on that narrative. It's very celebratory of, like Natalie was saying, the family communities that were there, the tight-knit nature of that community, and the Renaissance and style that, I think the reason that Woodstock looks dated is all those things had maybe already become cliches by the time that Woodstock was happening. And if they weren't already, they would be soon. Whereas Nina Simone walks out, that style, that's never going out of style. She's just cool. It's just badass.
That's right.
And that through line of expression runs into the crowd, not just on the stage. So I thought all of that was, it could have just been music, but immersing in that world, well, maybe it's because we've been landlocked for a year and it felt like traveling to a different place, but mm-hmm. that was a part of it. By the same token, watching people just revel in great art and be in community with each other after we've been so separate was, and we're starting to emerge again and kind of wondering. I saw a buddy tweeted, it's funny to be on the beach on the 4th of July and people are wearing all their America stuff and how many of them supported an insurrection. At a time where we're very divided, to see, you know, a profoundly divided time, people still expressing joy. And to say nothing of the music. The music was phenomenal. I mean, there was like edgier seat stuff, like Mavis Staples and Mahalia Jackson going back and forth.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
This is the one thing that I think will last with me after watching this is some of the things I'd heard about since I was a kid, like a 4-year-old kid, or just heard songs started to come into focus for me. You guys ever hear songs or see movies when you were 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, and then you see them again when you're an adult and you understand the thesis, you know?
Totally.
That's what happened. Like Soul Power, that term, I've heard that since I was 5.
Yeah.
I was 5 in 1981, so like that was still reverberating.
Right.
But I didn't know what it meant.
I mean, that and even their investigation into using the word black, you know, in print, like the New York Times switching over to using that word and them claiming it.
Yes. I never knew exactly when that dividing line was. We encounter the old-fashioned word for black in a lot of the readings I do in academics, and I didn't know there was a very clear dividing line for that. The lyrics to Everyday People. I've heard this song since I was 3, 4, whatever, however long I can remember. I didn't put that under any kind of lens when I was 7 and walking around singing it.
Sure.
Yeah, that's so good. And it looks so steeped in the vibrant, beautiful 60s that there were times where this almost looked like a parody of a 1972 show.
It's almost
the staging.
Yeah, and you look out in the crowd and you're like, everybody couldn't have looked that good. Like, both been that beautiful and dressed that beautifully. That's
shit, they were.
They
dude.
Were.
Wasn't that great? I guess that was Harlem in 1969, though.
Vibrant place to
maybe
be.
Maybe you walked around. Maybe there were just a few pockets that weren't quite as fashion, you know, satirically speaking. Anyway, let's start getting into some of the specifics. Well, I always heard that Stevie Wonder was a good drummer, and it was a thrill to see it. I knew that was going to be a part of it, so it was awesome to see it in the first scene.
To open the movie with, he's 19. He is 19 years old when he's doing that stuff.
And that's something that blew me away when they revealed he was 19. I had no idea that he was 19. I would have assumed he was 30 or something at that time. I've never really been sure of Stevie's age.
That was unbelievable.
To open and end with the gentleman who was, I guess, around 5 but he still remembers the festival quite clearly and going with it, and just have that opening shot to be his reaction to the film.
I thought that was a wonderful device that they used with some of the artists that they had on too, of showing them the footage. You know, because to them it could have been a huge deal, but it was also just one afternoon in their life of performing, and they can kind of start to blend together. I think revisiting that and seeing the same things that we're talking about, that it was so vibrant, and you almost wonder if you know, things kind of turn golden in your memory, and then to see like, oh, it really was, it lives up to the memory that I have of it. I've seen cool stuff on social media this weekend, like one person posted, we didn't know that my grandmother was there, and they had a still, like they had frozen their TV and were pointing, and it's like, that was her. She was there. They're like, they knew that she was around at the time. Like, I wonder if she went, and then there she is on screen. Just cool stories like that.
I bet they shit their pants.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Do you guys have a favorite performance? Natalie, did you have a favorite performance that you would love to watch over and over and over?
Anytime Mavis Staples is on a stage or with a microphone or just, you know, in a space, you know, I want to be there. I want to see it, and I will watch it and listen to it over and over again. But when Nina Simone comes out, I mean, that's just, what do you do?
She is powerful. She, you know, admonishes the crowd, and you never want to look away, though.
She's spellbinding, and I think if I had seen those clips 10 years ago, that would have been one thing. But to see it after the last few years and to understand the danger that she was inviting by saying what she was saying and doing what she was doing is really, I keep using the word powerful, but it was very powerful to watch that, you know, that was not, she's not saying things that are just intellectualized. You know, she is saying radical things to a group of people in a neighborhood that scares white America, mm-hmm. and just doing it unapologetically.
And part of the opening recounts what Black America was seeing and saying about the period of time. It's disheartening to hear that we have the exact same conversations and problems today.
Yeah.
It'll almost piss you off because you're thinking, this is exactly what we're having to deal with today, and it's 50 years later. So it was brief, but I'm really glad they covered the enormity of getting all that shit together, like a proper sound system. Sometimes I'll sit and wonder, how much of a trouble is it to set up a sound system in the middle of a park in New York? And they don't go into detail. They don't bore you with it. But I'm glad they say, hey, this was an issue. And he covered
it. Well, and even bringing the mayor into it.
Did you enjoy seeing the mayor?
I did enjoy seeing the mayor. I thought that was funny.
He's a very minor character in Mad Men, right?
He is. I thought about there's an episode where the riots are happening. And kind of all experiences that they have. And I definitely thought of Don being afraid of what was happening on the other side of Central Park. You know what I mean? He was very mm-hmm. safe where he mm-hmm. was.
So Natalie talks about Mavis Staples and Nina Simone. Did you have a favorite performance beyond those two?
The Mavis stuff was amazing. Nina Simone was definitely my favorite performance. I thought that was pretty spellbinding again. I thought that the way that they set up, the way they moved through all of the shows, you know, because they really did have like a gospel day, you know, mm-hmm. all these different kind of genres. But the way that they set up the slow reveal of Sly and the Family Stone was really, really great. I think it's kind of tough when they played Woodstock in the same few weeks. And I think like when they play Higher at Woodstock, that is, I'm not sure that rock, you know, I'm using the term just to describe the instruments on stage, rock music, guitars and bass and drums and keys. I'm not sure that there's ever been a better mm-hmm. performance than what they did at Woodstock on the song Higher. But so mm-hmm. it pales a bit in comparison to that. But as far as like a cultural moment, them coming out and being from the West Coast and unleashing this new brand of like soul rock, Sly mm-hmm. being from another planet, them not knowing if they're actually going to show up on time, all that kind of stuff. That was great.
I'm going to say two moments I think are must see are Gladys, well, just for fun, Gladys Knight and the Pips, watching those guys do those synchronized dances and singing.
So good. Know,
there was a moment on the screen where there's three guys there, and each of them sing a part, and I couldn't really see them on the screen, and I was like, wait, they're all away from the mic. How did they? But what they were doing is they were jumping back on mic one at a time with their synchronized dancing. Yeah.
And that was so including fun. That performance to me played with, you know, that there were folks coming out of gospel backgrounds, but then finding themselves, you know, having her out front and three dudes as the background singers doing synchronized dances is kind of playing with gender norms of the time. I don't know how like conscious they were of that, but that is it was just felt very different and very like, oh, there's a lot going on in Harlem.
And Gladys Knight doesn't age.
Yes.
Gladys Knight does not age. What is she doing? What's the magic there?
I think that's it. It's magic. It's just witchcraft.
I think it's when you bring that much joy to a society, you get paid back in karma.
You get a pass on aging.
I guess so. David Ruffin holding that one note in My Girl was the most impressive thing I've seen in years.
Him rolling out in a fur coat in Manhattan in late summer was also very impressive.
Did it not blow you? Have you guys not?
No,
y'all are both musicians.
That was amazing.
I couldn't believe it. And he was already hitting those high notes anyway in the song. And then he's just dancing. And like, And then bends over and hits this note and holds it. And I would challenge any, I don't want to be disparaging to people to, no, I do. I do want to be disparaging to people today. I want to challenge, you know, some of these performers who have to have backing tracks. And, you know, you hear people say, well, that he or she's got to have a backing track because she's doing a lot of dancing. Go watch that David Ruffin performance and tell me the difference. Show me that, you know, talk to me about the differences.
The ease and the, it's not, it is showmanship, but it doesn't come off that way where he just kind of struts on stage and is like, I'm going to sing one of the biggest songs of all time. And everybody here knows every single word, and I'm going to conduct an entire park in Harlem, basically, and do this. That was so good. I mean, that was like, there were a few moments like that that gave me chills to watch.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to get a technical question here that maybe one of you could answer. How in the hell does Stevie Wonder hit the right notes? Not talking about his eyesight or anything. How does he hit the right? It looks like he's just randomly throwing his hands on the keyboard. Is that just skill?
Yeah.
I see a lot of, not just Stevie, I see a lot of piano players do this. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way you can move your hands that fast and not just be hitting wrong notes.
He doesn't, though. I thought about him playing that clavinet and how, like in the studio now, if anybody like walks over and starts playing, it's like he has totally taken over an instrument, you know? Like, if you start playing that, it's like, oh, you're trying to do a Stevie Wonder thing, you know? And, like, they usually stop playing because he is... to just totally master one sound like that. And you weren't speaking of eyesight in that situation, but I will. When he starts standing up and is holding the microphone, puts the microphone back on the stand and lands on the right chord, that's hard to do whether you have 20/20 or not. Unbelievable.
You know, I see Jerry Lee Lewis doing things like
right.
that. Right. And then Stevie's doing it without, All right, so, brilliant move to let the performers in on the footage. I think it's the first time some of those performers have seen that footage, maybe all of them, and tell their own stories but react to the past by showing them that stuff and then capturing them on camera. It was a joy to see that.
It did a thing, thinking about that, where, and this is always true of people like Mavis Staples, especially people of that era who just were around everyone. Her talking about singing with Mahalia Jackson. I mean, Mahalia Jackson was born in 1911. You know what I mean? And the fact that we have this this through line who can be in a documentary and talk about the power of being a contemporary for that moment on stage and getting like that validation of riffing back and forth with her. I mean, that is some highly valuable insight and like a moment into American music history. Just like Mavis talking about her dad learning to play guitar on Dockery Farm. I mean, you can go look at Dockery Farms in Mississippi. If you ever go play in Cleveland, like we've done a billion times, you drive right by it. The fact that that cradle of music is on screen in this, you know, internationally celebrated documentary today, and Mavis is still there to talk about it with firsthand stories, is we're in a cool moment, I think, where these folks aren't going to be with us forever. And so hearing their voices was really special.
This documentary made me reflective on how some racist people won't ever change. They're not going to change. It really hit me with the Nina Simone section and performance. And I was just trying to imagine a bigoted person watching this documentary. And, you know, that's just not going to happen.
Which is a shame.
It's a shame because they're missing out on some good tunes. And some good lessons, beginning and ending with the pure love and awe of that guy, that concert goer, and seeing his own footage, or not his own footage, but seeing the footage that where he was, and saying, I'm not crazy. It's a masterful touch as an ending. So
it sure was.
That's where we'll break. Quick break. We're going to come back on the other side. Some brief thoughts. Well, somewhat brief on Somos and Loki. All right, thank you for listening. We're part of the Alabama Takes. It's our duty, but also our pleasure to let you know there's more to be found at the site where all of our projects, podcasts, and writings are housed. Visit it to see it all in one place. If you haven't, or if you're new, subscribe to this podcast in your app of choice and leave us a rating and review. Coming this week on Short Takes, that's our YouTube talk show, which airs every Friday. will be guest and author Tessa Fontaine. Tessa will tease a bit of what she's working on next. Subscribe to that YouTube channel so you don't miss anything from Short Takes and the Alabama Take future videos. Let's jump back into today's episode of Taking It Down. All right, we want to talk about the new Netflix show, Somos. It dropped on the last Friday. If you're listening on July 6th, it's the last Friday, it's new, Somos, which is about a Mexican border town called Allende and the effects of a cartel overtaking it. It's a limited series. All 6 episodes are streaming on that service, as Netflix is wont to do. They dropped all 6. I am 3 deep. I'm halfway through.
You beat us by 1.
Yeah, I almost beat you by 2. I nearly squeezed in the 4th one this morning, but I didn't. Adam, I'm going to go to you first for this one. You brought this series to the table, and I didn't get the details on it because I saved it for today. I think it would have slipped off my radar. This show would have slipped off my radar had you not mentioned it. I'll let you explain how you came to know about the show.
One of the writers on the show, I don't think there was like a singular person driving the whole vehicle. She is not quite, a famous enough writer to have that role yet. I think she will be. Fernanda Melchor. She wrote a book called Hurricane Season. She is based in Mexico, writes in Spanish, and it usually takes a few years for her works to be lovingly translated into English. Yeah, I read Hurricane Season. I think it came out sometime in the last 5 years, the translation, much more recently than that. I think it's one of the best modern, however you want to phrase that, novels that I've read. I think it was brutal. It was just inhabiting a world of its own. I'm so impressed with her as a writer. I'll read whatever is translated into English next that she does. So her involvement in this piqued my interest for sure.
I noticed friend and original Alabama Taker Caleb Johnson was reading that book. He posted it on his Instagram.
He did. We exchanged a bit about that because I posted about it when we read it a few months ago, and yeah, he said it was on his list for sure.
Yeah, when I saw him post, I thought, I think that's the novel Adam's been talking about or mentioned for this show. Somos on Netflix. We're definitely going to spoil the first 2 episodes. The first, and here it goes, by the way. So go. Well, before we spoil anything, you guys going to recommend this so far? Yay or nay?
I definitely do.
Okay, Natalie?
For sure.
Yeah? All right, here we go. First episode throws viewers right into the mix. This show has a very small Mexican border town, Allende, and it can be really hard to track the characters. It's as dense, if not more so, than Mayor of Easttown with its connective tissue.
Oh, more so, I would say. Yeah.
It reminded me of Mayor, because, you know, you've got the veterinarian, she's got a son, he's connected to the girl football player who's a student at his school, and then her, you know, it's just, there's everyone is their lines to draw. And I honestly thought if I had watched this when I was 16 or 17, I would have totally opened up a notebook and drew and written the characters' names down and drew not a family tree, but like a character tree.
Like a Charlie, Always Sunny-esque, totally Sylvia situation. That's kind of, I felt that kind of scattered.
That meme, yeah. The first, so that's, I'm going to say this. I don't think a lot of our listeners, because I trust the intelligence of our listeners, but I bet there are people who would be put off by the first episode, even if they can get, you know, some people can't get past subtitles. It is in Spanish. But even if they could get past that, they're going to be put off by, what, the density of this, of just the characters?
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, like, I don't love shows like this in general. I think the older that I get, like, if I go to something for entertainment, I just want it to be lighthearted and fun at this point in my life.
So but when you say shows like this, you mean serious and
kind of... Yeah, like these kind of darker dramas where like you can tell something bad is inevitably going to happen.
Gotcha.
But this one, because there were so many characters and it was so diverse, I think that made it interesting to me. And whereas normally I might just have checked out, like I was invested because there are a few characters like maybe a bad thing's not going to happen to that one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure it will, mm-hmm. but hopefully not. But it, for me, it made it easier to watch because it was not all dark. It was still like, oh, there's some kids that are playing football and they're having fun and they're just pals. And
what's your level of surprise that they're playing American football at this high school?
That was really funny.
I mean, I didn't know that was, I sincerely did not know that was a thing.
It's a thing. This is, yeah. I only know because of like the college football subreddit has talked about it in the past. So they have a great Twitter account and they will even tweet about like the, I guess, colleges playing each other down there. I will say that me and Natalie both kind of smiled about the depiction of football. Maybe that the directors, the people working on the show have not spent a lifetime with American football like we have. Much like I would not think that we would really nail a soccer in American Hollywoodization has probably been butchered in the past. It was, you know, the football scenes were okay.
What jumped out to you on the, they felt like, oh, that's not quite authentic. They didn't.
It was just kind of funny. It was like, it was more like they had the idea of football versus like a lived experience. I mean, Natalie, what we
those
both
scenes were so quiet.
It. Yeah.
They were so quiet.
That was what was weird to me. Like anytime football is on any other show, like there's music in the background, there's people yelling, whistles blowing. That was the quietest football scene I've ever seen.
Which could be like, that's, it could be how it is down there.
Yeah. Could be.
Maybe they don't incorporate a band and the crowds aren't that big or something.
Yeah. I guess it would be more of a curiosity than a main draw, American football.
Yeah. So episode one ends, I think, ominously enough that even for the casual viewer, if they made it to the end of episode one, or if you're curious, that's probably going to be enough to keep customers returning to the store. And it, again, I say, I would, you almost need a character chart, but I also usually, you know, I trust the filmmaker, that's not the right word, the series, the showrunner, whomever. I usually trust whomever's involved to, they're going to walk me through who everyone is in the second and third episode, which definitely happened. So once you flow with these characters being so interconnected, you'll arrive at episode two, which is, I think, the point. That's where the series leaves you really wanting more, particularly with the ending. Because it's compelling to me that the writers would have known that the audience, we as an audience, know the outline. I mean, it's on the Netflix homepage. A small town gets taken over by a cartel. So they are going to trust the audience. Are they going to you know, they're going to trust themselves and the audience to build a gripping enough narrative around, so how do we get there and what's going to happen? They've done this thing where they try to make you care or be interested in every character because you know, like Natalie was pointing out, you know something bad or you know what level of horror is going to be bestowed upon these people.
That was totally my approach to it as I'm getting to know these characters is kind of doing like a, you know, sort of run odds in your head of like, who should I emotionally invest in so that I'm not totally wrecked by however the end is coming. Because, I mean, it starts at the beginning, right? A pretty profound act of violence happens. And then they say 3 months
opening
earlier.
Opening scene.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you
that's
know
a
they're
short
building.
Time.
Yeah. You know they're building towards that, and you know, it's like the human nature thing of wanting to find who you're going to root for, and they really punch you in the gut with that on episode two, I thought, because they, poor Paquito.
He's the kind of guy where you might even hate at first.
Yeah, I didn't like him at first.
I ne'er-do-well.
Yeah.
This guy, he's laying around mooching off his mother-in-law, but then you don't want that to happen to him. I found a couple of, this is my one critique so far, is that there are a few stiff performances. There are some of these people who are not seasoned actors. The kids.
For sure.
When they're alone, when it's just like the three or four kids, those seem really stiff.
Yeah.
The DEA agents across the border at the, what is that, at the end of episode two, toward the end of episode one or two, it was kind of jarring how they were. I didn't buy them. I don't know.
Yeah.
And they appear more in episode three, and they get a little bit better, but it's a little bit rough to.
A lot of unknowns in this show, right? A lot of unknown actors, or at least for us.
Yeah, 100%.
I think it's a great glimpse into the fact that Fernanda Melchor is on board and has written for it. Already kind of made me expect a more authentic experience than you know, there's the meme that's been going around for a few months of filmmakers in America, and it's like a normal vision, and then filmmakers when Americans go to Mexico and everything turns yellow, you know, and gets kind of like heightened reality kind of stuff. So I thought this will be a antidote to that in some ways, but it's also, you know, in Melkor's writing, she accepts that she lives somewhere where truth is stranger than fiction often, and these really devastatingly violent things happen and very odd things happen. And, you know, these people are living in a world where they can't really trust each other or the government or the police or all these things. And there's a entity just across the border that is indifferent or hostile even, and like how to navigate those waters. So I thought this is, you know, it could be like a Sicario or a even Breaking Bad when they go to Mexico. You just kind of feel that you are in a war zone at all times, whereas this is a lot more grounding. You know, that there are teenagers who are not dealing drugs. They're like doing homework and things like that. It's a much more...
playing Call of Duty.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a much more grounded... even though you know things are going to go sideways and get hyper-violent or... whatever's coming, we know what's coming, but however that's presented, it felt more like a fully fleshed out story already to me.
Natalie, you are I'm gonna guess you're pulling for Hector.
That depends on which one is Hector.
So Hector is the guy who seems to be in charge of the whorehouse.
Oh,
the guy with the
phone.
Well,
I was pulling for the cowboy
with
but
the phone.
Now he's dead. Spoiler alert.
Oh yeah. Cow. Mm-hmm.
Why that? I mean, the cow. Man, that broke my heart seeing all those cows.
Yes, it did. Yeah, they're doling out information. It's a good show. I think it's good. It hasn't garnered high praise. There's a little bit of just me skimming headlines. There's a little bit of compare and contrast to this show in Narcos. And I don't know if that's 100% fair, though obvious. It is obvious.
I don't feel like it's a fair comparison.
Okay.
That's not fair at all. I mean, you have one of the most...
Go on.
You have one of the most fascinating figures in the 20th century. And to ground the show and to make... You know, who would have guessed that, like, Pablo Escobar memes would exist now, but they do. And people found his... Because the performance was so good. Mm-hmm. But compare it to, like, later seasons of Narcos, not Pablo. If anything, and people don't talk about those seasons as much.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They're supposedly good, but I bailed after Pablo. That was the story I wanted.
I've watched a few episodes, and it's good, but it's not... to me, it follows more of the... Breaking Bad is on a different level, but like the Sicario kind of vibe. You know, it kind of mines those waters versus... This feels much more... I'm impressed that we've made it this far without saying the words David Simon, but... It feels more like create a whole ensemble community and have them react to this instead of like relying. There were a lot of characters in Narcos too, but it all came back to Pablo being Pablo.
Yeah, with character depiction, there is a little bit of debt to be paid to David Simon, maybe, who probably owes debts to others.
Of course,
him, but they're just like, we're just going to start. Here are the characters. You'll figure them out. Or you won't.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's draw a line here. No clear segue, maybe. Characters, I don't know. Let's give some thoughts on the most recent episode of Loki, the fourth of that series, and was titled The Nexus Event. Okay, Natalie, I feel like we've held you back a little, but this is where we're going to get out of the way for you. We got Loki on deck. I was actually considering putting Talk of Loki on the shelf this week, but it was such an eventful episode that it seemed hard for me to do that. And I think I'll just go into sequential order of some of the big events or reveals and ask opinions and thoughts of you. So Sylvie has been on the run since a child. She mentions this in a previous episode, but here we get to see that it's that lady, the supervisor to Mobius Ravonna, who has it... She's got it stuck in her craw to get this Sylvie. Even as a kid, she was after her. And we don't get to see why. We just see them appear as Sylvie was a little girl and say, come with us. Right? Am I interpreting that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just she's playing with her Valkyrie toys, and there's, and she asked, what was my next event? And of course, Ravona Renslayer, or whatever her name is, plays it off like it was not even worth remembering. But we know that's not true. I mean, it had to have been something major for this small child to have registered as such a problem for the TVA.
You have speculations on that?
I have somebody I don't remember what podcast I was listening to about it, but somebody pointed out that the story that she is playing out with like her toys is she's playing the hero. And somebody mentioned like, what if the Nexus event was this is a Loki who's taking the good path and that can't happen.
Oh,
Which is
okay.
like, that's
Yeah.
wild, but I mean maybe. If this is a kid, a Loki who wants to be the good guy and wants to actually save people, save the day, as opposed to just cause trouble all the time, then that may not be okay with the time, whatever the sacred timeline.
Now I'm trying to think of how that connect to future movies and stuff, like making Thor a bad guy.
Oh,
In a
that would be
interesting.
weird.
Did either of you read the AV Club's review of this episode from Caroline Seedy?
I don't
Seed?
think I
Seedy? I'm
did.
not sure. Yeah. Well, she was definitely not for it, even saying that the writers don't have the skill to pull off what they're doing in this episode. She's kind of brutal, but she still gives it a B. She says that they're trying to present major and shocking reveals, and they're not able to do that, and complains that the writers haven't set up Loki and Sylvie to be in love with one another appropriately in the previous episode.
I mean, yes, I guess in a way, but I think we've all made the mistake going through all of these Disney Plus shows of overthinking too many things. And I think that's probably just overthinking it. And the whole him being in love with himself, I've seen a lot of comparisons to this is, I mean, we just saw him going through the whatever the time lock prison thing, being told over and over again, you will be alone for the rest of your life. So obviously there, and he accepts that. He's like, yeah, you're right. And that's why I do all these terrible things is to try to get people's attention. So for him to fall in love with himself, whatever that means, if that's just him accepting himself and like it becomes like this like self-love kind of a thing, not like an actual like narcissistic, but more of like, millennial self-care, whatever, which I'm all about, by the way. But I mean, maybe that, I mean, if that's the route, I mean, I think for it to be that, for it just to be self-love for a guy who clearly has had issues with that in the past, I mean, it makes sense to me. Works for me.
That's great. Lots of chatter online about the appropriateness of Loki falling for a version of himself, but when you interpret it like that, it makes perfect sense, and not just makes sense, but is wonderful. Head writer Michael Waldron recently spoke to Marvel.com about that decision, and he said, "We went back and forth for a little bit, do we really want to have this guy fall in love with another version of himself? Is that too crazy? But in a series that to me is ultimately about self-love, self-reflection, and forgiving, it just felt right." And yeah, that's exactly what you're saying. So Lady Sif makes a cameo. Well,
Which is
she hasn't been
great.
around in a while.
Always good
Yeah,
to
you
see
like
Lady
that?
Sif. Yeah, she's great.
And it's possible she could come back in some other stuff. I bet she'll she might be used in the new Thor.
Yeah, we don't really know what happened to her, do we?
I don't think so. Not to my knowledge. They make better use of the actor. What's her name? She was in the Lovecraft Country, and she plays B-15, the hunter. Make better use of her in this. What is her name? Wumni Masaku, something like that. It makes a lot more sense that she's hired to play that role. When she first appeared in episode one, I was thinking, what? Well, is this a small role for her? Is it? But Marvel's kind of, they do that. They hire anybody they want.
She's great. That'll be my me weighing in. I think she's a great
I've
actor,
got a
and
couple questions for you.
I thought the same thing when she kind of went by as like a security guard in the first episode. More than you don't really know the role of that of those folks, and she was in the next few, but having her have this epiphany was and maybe being the first convert was very good, I thought, because I think she's really great.
You needed a strong actor for that role, because of there's a pretty emotional scene. I was confused by the Nexus event of the title. that supposedly got the TVA's attention, but it took me a minute, I think, after thinking about it. It's just that it wasn't shown. And I think that's where. I debated watching it again. Also, the Hunters, C-20, or maybe that's not a Hunter. Is that a variant? Natalie, do you know? Mm-hmm. Is it C-20 a variant or a Hunter? They keep talking about that. I was confused by
So all of the Hunters were variants. But, yeah, so C-20 is the Hunter that Sylvie initially took and got all the information about where the timekeepers are.
She was the one in the Alabama hurricane.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
She found her truth in Alabama.
Hey, who doesn't?
Gold Shores.
That's right.
I think that's a speckled bird lyric, isn't it?
It is. Stay tuned.
Mobius and Loki both get pruned, but the end of the show lets us know that might be permanent. And then we get the timekeepers aren't real, or at least have some sort of robotic stand-ins in case of emergency. Do they exist at all?
I don't know at this point. Maybe they existed at some point, but I was honestly very, when we finally see the timekeepers, I was like, they look terrible. This is some bad, whether it was CGI or puppetry, whatever. Like, this looks so corny. So with the fact that they turned out to be androids or robots, whatever, it's like, thank God that these were not supposed to be like real, because they looked horrible.
It's a tough one, man. Marvel may have dug themselves into a hole with this plot point with the timekeepers. So are they real? Are they not? Where are they? Were those robots just a safety measure? I don't know. Well, I guess we'll find out something.
Sorry, nobody seemed like when Sylvie chopped the head off, none of the other people in the room seemed to care. Like old Renslayer, she's like she obviously had to have known that they weren't real, because there was no response from her. But then if she knows they're not real, why did she go with this big show? I don't know, but it was so strange that there was no reaction from anybody.
If you're in that room, you have to have already known the truth, right?
You would think so, but then why? I don't. There was a lot of like performative stuff that was happening. I don't know. Just
power.
Why are we
power
wasting our time
with
this?
Power is why you would not say anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One more Loki variant is Richard E. Grant. That's a big actor to get into a goofy costume.
A very goofy costume.
I'll make one more comment and then just let you guys wrap. What the destroyed world Loki comes to after he's been pruned, he comes awake. That looks a lot like a bigger city that's in ruins, a la a New York if he had won against the Avengers or something.
Well, I mean, you see the ruins of Avenger Stark Tower, I guess, at that point in the background. So,
is that what it was? I was kind of on the right?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. Adam, what are you thinking about Loki so far? Because you are playing catch up a little, but I think you are. Obviously, you're caught up.
I think it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I thought that it's tough not to compare these shows that they've been coming out with. So like WandaVision was great, top to bottom. I didn't even finish the Winter Tinker Tailor Soldier whatever show. That was not good, I didn't think. Maybe it suffered from being sandwiched between two higher quality things. It just felt like a mid-2000s action movie, which is fine. Maybe I'm obviously not the target demographic for any of this, but Loki is fun. I think some of the revelations have been interesting. The idea of a TVA is fun, but I do get a bit exhausted with like the stakes for the, is the word actually pruning?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what happens when they, okay.
Yeah. And I guess the choice is not killing or deleting or whatever, because
well, I guess they're pruning the timeline. It's literally like
they're trimming it up.
Yeah, you're trimming and trying to keep it in order. So yeah, pruning makes sense. But it felt very low stakes the whole time, because you know that this is a universe with multiple timelines and realities and all this kind of, it's like nobody ever dies here. So like when he gets pruned and wakes up and there's, it's like, of course, this shit again. Of course. I get kind of exhausted with that kind of thing, but it's been pretty fun.
Iron Man is dead, for sure.
Yeah.
That seems to be.
Black Widow's dead.
Yeah, that's true.
Black Widow seems to be dead, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, okay. people die for sure, but you knew that he, in episode whatever of a however long, basically the midway point, it's like, we're not going to kill off these main actors right now. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I did think to myself, oh, wait, there's two episodes left. They're not going to remove Tom Hiddleston. Yeah. They're not going to give the ball to Sophia, the actress of the Sylvia actress, I was thinking.
Do you think Owen Wilson?
I do think Owen Wilson is fantastic in this. Yeah,
Owen Wilson will have to, I'm sure.
I think he's so great in this.
He's got to. Or at least in my book, I hope. Yeah, are there parallel universes? Are there a multitude of different Adams who made different choices, different Natalies who did whatever?
Probably so.
I don't know.
I'm willing to accept that for sure.
I've only been willing to accept that recently.
I hope so.
Yeah. Huh. interesting stuff. Something we can touch on with more episodes of Loki. So that's it for this week. The first one of July. We'll be back next Tuesday bright and early, and we hope you'll join us again. Hit us up online. Thanks for listening. I will say we've got a lot of choices for the month of July.
Things pick back up.
Yeah, things are picking up. We could cover Fear Street, that movie on Netflix. We could cover Loki. We could cover the HBO Max movie No Sudden Move from Steven Soderbergh. That sounds promising. Black Widow releases, I think, between now and next week. We've got the HBO show The White Lotus, which I think we're all going to be watching over the next few weeks. So there you go, listeners. If you like playing along with our cast here, those are definite possibilities. I think the low end would be the Fear Street movie on Netflix, but the rest do sound like something we might talk about. That's it for this week. We're going to talk to you down the road. See you.